At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
They are the biggest. They're the ones that I look at as like trying to chase a monopoly and owning the industry. They also have like a bunch of problematic shit. I have a friend who had a film that was offered to be made by Tencent or funded by Tencent, and they were like, no black people, bigger tits.
Wait, what?
Like a lot of like rules that they have that
okay,
yeah, that I think also has had a hand in, you know, some AAA games. Again, I don't want to speak on any of this because I'm so worried about getting sued by Tencent, but this is what I've heard, rumors, not sure if any of this is true. But, you know, like, even games that are out where they were like, yeah, that character needs to have bigger tits, or you need to make her skin lighter type shit.
Wow. Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. That's amazing. It worked on the first try.
I love that for us.
I know, right? It actually never happens, so it's quite fantastic. How's it going, Alana?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. I was just watching all the anti-lockdown rallies that are going on worldwide and enjoying the fun.
Yep. It's, you know, still a state that we're in, and I love this for all of us.
Absolutely.
That said, like, I feel like everybody who plays video games is always fine with lockdowns. I never had a problem. I was completely fine.
I was also going to say, we got out easy on that one. I got to catch up on, like, all the games I've been missing out on.
Totally. Yeah, it was great. Got through backlogs. Yeah, basically not a problem.
Do you want to give everyone a quick introduction to yourself, where they can find you, the socials and all that wonderful stuff?
Sure. Hello. My name's Alana Pierce, and I am a video game writer currently working at Sony Santa Monica Studio, but I'm also a content creator. I make a bunch of podcasts, mostly. And I am on all of the social media at Charalanazard, which is my name in the middle of Charizard. Nobody ever knows how to spell it. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
I guess the first question I was going to ask you is, what made you want to get into writing video games?
When I grew up, I always loved video games and I always loved writing. It was always those two things. So I feel like I like cheated. You know, there are people who don't know what they wanted to do their whole lives. I figured it out by, I was like, the time I was 10, maybe. I was writing books as soon as I could write and playing video games as soon as I could figure out how to do that. So I just put those two things together and it made sense.
So for someone like me who also grew up absolutely loving video games, you'll have to explain, how does the writing process work for something that's like AAA? Because in my head, I've got this idea where it's like, oh, I could write the God of War story. Cool. And then, but obviously I'm assuming you are with like a team of people, like a hive mind, who all have to combine on a script to make it that grandiose.
Yeah, I try to be a little bit careful about how I talk about Santa Monica Studio specifically, even though I'm sure I could. I just try to, like, you know, not share how the studio specifically works. But speaking on it on a broader scale, it's not super different to a TV writer's room. There are, like you said, a bunch of people who come together who have a lot of meetings, which are called writer's rooms, where you brainstorm certain ideas, go over certain characters, pitch ideas that you have, and then you take that all away. Generally think up more ideas for the next pitch meeting, and then each person will be assigned like a different thing to write. So you're usually taking certain characters that you gravitate towards, or sometimes like a full episode is how it works in TV. In a lot of AAA, it's, you know, a certain level, for example. There are some studios that have it where one person writes only one character. I think that is slightly less popular these days, though, because it can be really limiting. So it's figuring out how to make sure you all write the characters the same way. You know them all. You know every character's like plot point and turns. And I feel like the plots come off of the characters everywhere that I've ever written fiction. I think it's a lot easier to write if you have complex characters and simple plots, at least to begin with, and then everything expands from there. But yeah, a lot of people talking in a room and then banging shit out on a keyboard and trying to figure it out, basically.
I was going to ask, who kind of has the overarching idea? Like, if I was to take a game, say, like BioShock Infinite, is it the director himself and then a team of people who are like, the core idea of this is going to be surrounding, you know, finding this individual, rescuing her, and then the whole thing being about dimensions? Or is it kind of like the writer's room hashes out what the main idea is going to be, and then you start to build from there?
Depends on the game. So I imagine with BioShock, that's Ken Levine. I feel like Ken Levine probably came to the writer's room and was like, here's the ideas that I have. And then the writer's jobs are actually to fix a lot of the problems because nobody has a perfect idea. So it is like so collaborative. That's why AAA gaming is like 400 plus people to make something. So in that a situation, I would imagine, like I said, Ken Levine comes and is like, here's kind of the vision that I have. And then the writers go, okay, well, I don't like that part, or this part maybe isn't strong for this reason. How do we fill in some of your holes but keep your vision together? And then, you know, that there's ongoing pitch meetings. So it's super collaborative. Some studios, and I feel like it shows very well, and as a writer, I would hate to ever have to work at one of these studios. They do gameplay first. Level design and gameplay all come first, and then they hire writers sometimes like last minute on a project. And I feel like you can always tell the games that do that because they have terrible stories. The video game industry is like now coming around to realizing that stories are important and that people get more invested in games if they care more or they feel emotionally connected to the characters. So that's certainly changing. But yeah, there are some studios who just don't even think about it, let it happen way last minute, and it's writers in a room trying to like scramble in to figure out how a plot is going to fit into the already established levels. Santa Monica Studio, like publicly known for not being like that. It's a very story first studio. Rockstar would be a very story first studio. So it's, you know, the writers working with the rest of the narrative design team, then working with the every other team. Obviously, cinematics team's a huge part. Animation, I mean, that's just so many people. But yeah, it definitely depends on the studio. But I would say directors, like generally, their job is to maintain the vision across all of those different departments. So making sure that every single different department, all, you know, 300 whatever people who work on a AAA game, are working towards the same goal and making sure everything feels really cohesive.
Because there is so many moving parts, at what point does the writer's room have to come up with, say, X amount of content and then deliver that to whatever the next phase may be? Like, are you doing this in conjunction with a coding team working on an engine, or is it you start to come in after some preliminary stuff of the game has already been established?
Depends on the game. Again, and the studio and where they're at what time in development of what thing, really. So I think that that varies like really significantly. It's not unheard of that writers are the first part of a project. That can happen. I mean, generally, you already have an engine, or you know what engine you're going to use before you would start writing. But that doesn't mean that anyone's working on it or is actively programming it. But yeah, I feel like that one's hard to answer other than to say it like could be different at literally every studio. Like it varies significantly. I think that, you know, a lot of AAA studios, like, you know, your Call of Duties and your Assassin's Creeds, who are working on 3+ games at any one period of time, I would imagine how they function, having not worked on either of those games, is that they have writers, as soon as they finish the first project, move on to the next one while they wait for the rest of the team to be done, because in theory, you can kind of finish writing a little bit earlier. Otherwise, I can't picture how else they get a game out every year. So it's, I feel like, gotta be just writers moving and everybody else moving as soon as they're ready to move. Maybe it's not even that organized. Just like whoever is done with the previous game and can be moved on to the next project has got to move on to the next project so they can keep churning games out.
How much creative freedom do you have working for a studio that, well, you don't have to answer because you don't answer about your own studio, but how much freedom do writers in the industry working at your level typically have compared to what the vision of the director who's working on the game is, right? Like, does that depend on what section of the game itself you're responsible for writing? Is there a lot of pushback in terms of like, hey, there's this character that I've created and I want to explore this arc with him, maybe for a side quest or something? Or will they tell you, well, no, we'd rather you go down this road?
So I have worked on a number of games, some of them just not announced yet, some of them have been, and I think my experiences are pretty consistent across the board where it depends on the topic. So there are going to be certain things that certain people, not even the director, are really attached to and don't want to change. So like, you know, if even one of the writers in the writer's room is really attached to this certain thing, everyone else is going to be like, okay, well, we'll always let you write that thing, or if I have questions about that area, I'm going to go to you and ask about it. But yeah, there'll be things that you have tons of flexibility on and things that you don't have very much. Like there are core things that are like, this has to be this way because we've already tied this when talking to, you know, the cinematics team about this thing or whatever, or budget has been allocated for this large thing to happen, and if we get rid of that, then budget changes. Like, that stuff's all very high level, but yeah, it depends what it is, and I'm sure that there are things that I really care about a lot that I would, like, fight if somebody tried to get rid of it or take it away from me, but I think for the most part, it's maybe more collaborative than people think it is, because everybody just wants to make a good game.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody just wants to make something that people will really like, and you trust the people that you're working with every day to also feel that way and not to be precious, because when it comes out, nobody knows what you did. Mm-hmm. They say, like, you know, the writing term, like, that it can be hard to kill your darlings, but nobody knows what you did or didn't do. Who cares if it gets cut? I don't think there's any benefit to having ego in there. And again, I'm sure those people exist in the industry, but my experiences have all been very collaborative and very, like, you know, you could tell a director you don't like their idea, and they'd be like, interesting, why? Not shut up.
Well, but
again, I'm sure it depends on the director.
Do you find that there's ever been, like you said, that no one really understands who did what part in a game, because the fandom for some of those games can be aggressive, to put it lightly. People take their things very passionately. If there is a title that comes out that they don't enjoy, is that something that you ever find that they go after, like, the writing team, or is it just they go after the studios themselves? Like, how could Activision do this to us?
I mean, I'm actively aware that if there are things in God of War Ragnarok that people don't like, I will get blamed for it. Like, I 100% know that, even if I had nothing to do with it, because I already have been. Mm-hmm. There have already been things in trailers that people have been like, I fucking blame a lot of peers for this. Like, I have literally nothing to do with that. So I think, like, generic answer is, in a lot of cases, they target the people who are the most visible, or they'll target potentially women, minorities, depending on the person. That's not to say all gamers do that. I don't think like that. I feel like that's fair, but there are certainly some people who will target me because I'm a woman. I've had, like, some comments where people are like, oh, you're going to make Kratos gay because of course you are. I'm like, yeah, that's that's me coming in, pushing the gay agenda. But yeah, I mean, I think I don't feel like it necessarily is going to go to the whole writers team. It's just going to go to whoever's most visible, really, which, yeah, it's going to be a fun time for me.
How is the representation of women in video game writing? Is it like other areas where it's just dramatically underrepresented, or is it becoming better? What would you...
I actually feel like, of all the writers' rooms that I've been in, I'd never been in one that didn't have women in it. My meetings right now are majority women. So yeah, I would say writing is an area that women tend to gravitate towards. So thus, yeah, there are a lot of women writing video games.
Wow.
It feels pretty good to me.
So all the right-wing pop culture detectives who are really upset that women are destroying video games, there's actually truth to the conspiracy
100%
theories.
100% correct, yes.
Wow. There you heard again, it here first. I'm glad. The agenda is here. In other areas, I guess, in video games, there's obviously been a problem for women to kind of expand into, because it's just been so predominated by men. I guess, would this be one of the few examples where you could see that this is a better point of entry for maybe women who are trying to explore or get into the field itself?
Probably. I mean, even in media, I feel like you so often see female writers, so that representation is there. Like, it's a known thing that women are stereotyped to do, so thus you're probably challenged less than you are if you're a programmer or something. But Santa Monica Studio is, you know, we have a women at PlayStation division that's super supportive, and the studio is actually run by technically two women. So there are a lot of, and it's been that way for a really long time. There are a lot of women at the studio, and I feel like everyone's very accepting of all ilk of people, for sure. There from my experience, at the very least. But there are loads of women doing programming as well, and I feel like maybe sometimes part of the problem is, like, you don't necessarily see them as visibly, because for them to be more visible, in theory, could increase harassment, and it's just scary to get into. But I think the whole industry is, like, as it's becoming more and more acceptable for women to even play video games. Like, I was still on the cusp of getting picked on about that as a kid. More from girls, though. Like, I feel like girls made fun of me in school more than boys did. Boys didn't care that I played video games. Girls were like, I don't care. Stop talking to me about Dead Rising, which is the thing that actually happened. A girl I was friends with was like, I just don't fucking care. You have to stop talking to me about this. And I was like, that's fair. I should pick who I talk to about my interest in Dead Rising right now. But that's certainly going away, so I feel like the whole thing's just going to change. It's getting easier, and I've been in the industry for 10 years, and it went from people like not believing I played video games at all to now I don't feel like people say that. People like attack me for how I feel about them, but I very rarely have people accuse me of not playing video games, and that's a huge shift just in the 10 years that I've been in the industry.
I guess that's progress in one way. I was going to ask, because a lot of people obviously in the AAA game, you don't have to respond at all about Santa Monica, but to say other game studios, you always hear about things like The Crunch, for example, and how workers are having to be pushed to the brim to make deadlines. Does that impact the writers as well? And if so, how?
For sure. Again, I've actually not worked Crunch, so I can't, any game I've worked on, so I can't speak to this from any of my own experiences. But yeah, you can 100% have crunch as a writer. And I think that a lot of that would actually, this is sort of a guess more than anything, come from a AAA video game, or at least a big video game. So many moving parts, like just a tremendous amount of things that are changing, and a team has accomplished one thing and another one has done another thing, and you come together and you try to make the thing work. It's a mess. And crunch for writers, I think, could probably come from cinematic having to be cut. We're like, okay, the game is now too big. We have to cut this cinematic. So in order to balance that out, the writers are going to have to fill the holes that's created by that cinematic being cut, or changes to the story. Like, this couldn't happen. It was too complicated to program. We couldn't make the gameplay work in this section. So the writing has to adapt to that piece being gone. And that's part of the job, is being super adaptive and, you know, reacting to the changes of this whole, like I said, digital broken machine sort of slowly coming together in scrappy bits and pieces. Because game development is not glamorous, and I think anybody who works in the industry is like very open about that. Like, it's just broken so much of the time, and the fact that it ever is not is a miracle, not the other way around. But yeah, that's definitely a big one, is that the writers have to be really adaptive really quickly to service other teams, for sure.
Are the writers who work in that industry, are they exclusive to each company they work for, or do they also write for other mediums? Like, would you also be a TV writer or a movie writer, or are you allowed to freelance, or is it that you have to work specifically for the company you work for?
Depends on your contract. I personally, because I can't be actually employed like a regular full-time employee because of my visa, that gives me more contractual freedom. So like, there are some writers at Sony who would not be able to talk to you right now at all without asking. I don't have to do that, because technically they don't have ownership of me in that way because of my visa, which is ups and downs to that, for sure. But yeah, it depends on the industry. So like, I could write other video games right now if I wanted to. I think that would be exhausting. I have done a little bit of work on some indie games actually since I've been working in SMS, but very little, because it would be very tiring. And it's also like, when you're writing something, any medium, even like some of the TV stuff that I've worked on before, if you care about it, you just care so much about it that it can be hard to think about anything else. You get so into the one thing that you're writing that can be difficult to think about other things in the same level of depth. So I don't know that many people would want to, but yeah, I imagine that some companies are okay with it and some are strictly not okay with it. There are writers on my team who've come exclusively from TV, who didn't have games experience, and I think that there's like a lot of fresh perspective that comes with that, where I was told even in my interviews that they considered it an asset that I know so much about video games, or played so many video games, because then that like works with other people on the team, and I do not have TV experience, barely watch any TV. So there are all these like different references and you know, pop culture references that we can pull from different people. But yeah, I would say that a lot of, from the writers that I know super well, I feel like a lot of video game writers have also worked on comics. I feel like that's really common. Okay. For some reason. But you can obviously go from working on TV to working on a video game. Happened with The Last of Us Part 2, and then, you know, some of those writers are now going to work on The Last of Us TV show. So yeah, it crosses. The disciplines are not that different. I would think that writing video games is probably off-putting to a lot of writers, because the credits can be really slow. You know, it can take 3 years to make something, whereas TV, it's can be way faster than that. So I don't know if too many TV writers are like jumping at the bit to get in video games. But yeah, I mean, it's writing. That was definitely a thing that happened when I first joined the studio. People were like, most of your experience is journalism. That's completely different kind of writing. And I'd be like, it's not, though. Like, it's totally not. There are people from like studios with games that you love, like Hades. You know, that whole studio was effectively founded or written by people who came from a journalism background. The writing's pretty cross-disciplinary, I think.
Speaking of which, like, a lot of the modern AAA games now seem to really become more and more cinematic, or at least people are expecting them to, whether or not they can execute it properly, right? Like The Last of Us, Last of Us 2, for example, feeling a lot more like a film experience than simply a video game one. Do you feel the pressure having to work in that environment to kind of adapt that new level of, I don't know, cinematic quality when it comes to video game storytelling? Because you come from a background, clearly, of someone who was obsessed and knows a lot about the video game history, right? But then to have to combine that with what people are expecting from AAA games these days.
I feel like I would try not to think about those expectations too much. Like I said, I just want to make a good video game. And that applies to any of the games that I've worked on. It's like, I just want to do my job well and write what I'm told to write, do it well and come up with ideas and help other people with their ideas. And just like in the moment, make sure that I'm doing my best to make something good. I don't feel like I try to think about like the expectation, because I also, you know, you'd be limited working on a lot of games. This happened to me a little bit more with some of the indie stuff that I've done, where you can pitch something and they're like, "That's way too expensive. There's just no way that we can afford to do that." I'm like, "Oh, we can't afford to animate a dragon? Good to know." So you can be restricted by like the epic of things based on budget. That stuff can be really expensive. Anything with four legs is inherently more expensive. As an example, it's just hard to animate. They can't do it. But yeah, I don't know. I try not to think about expectation or scale. I just try to think about like writing a good story or making interesting characters more than anything. That would be way too stressful. Like as soon as you start thinking like, "Oh, how many million people could play this?" Oh no, that seems like a bad idea.
Okay, so if you're pushing yourself away from that and you're just trying to concentrate on the game, do you also find that what is happening to the video game industry itself, because you're actually working for it, do you pay attention to either controversies or like the way mobile games took over, or now NFTs are getting into games? Like, does that aspect and all the drama that surrounds the industry itself, do you push that out of your head as well, or do you kind of stay in tune to it while it's happening?
I'm separate, you know? Feel very lucky to work at a Sony first party studio, because from my perception, they are not pushing NFTs, microtransactions, none of that kind of stuff. They really just want to make very good video games, because that's how you sell PlayStations, I guess. So those conversations still happen, and I feel like that's a separate part of my brain. So like my day job is video game writer, and that's the stuff I do from 9 to 6 every day. And then the content creator side of me is on the other side of that, and that's where I absorb all of that information and think about that stuff. And I feel like I have a really good job of separating the two of them, of not thinking about them in the same breath, really. So, like, the content creator side of me is, like, thinking about NFTs and microtransactions and exploitative practices, or you know, I have real issues with certain games who are, or studios that are intentionally trying to, wouldn't be the studios, to be fair, it would be publishers, trying to make games more addictive so that you are addicted to a certain feedback loop of a certain game so that that's all you want to play. I think there are real problems there worth exploring. But yeah, I have it very separate in my head from what I do every day. That said, I would be uncomfortable if an exec came to me at any game that I would ever work on and would be like, "We need to figure out a way to write this so that, you know, it's more advantageous for us to have microtransactions in it." And I don't doubt that a lot of devs have to deal with that and confront that and probably don't want to do it, or in some cases do want to do it. It would depend on the person, but I don't even know how I would respond to like having to put in some practices I can consider to be occasionally predatory. I feel like I would have a lot of trouble with that. I guess it when it's your job, you just kind of got to do it, and that's probably the stance a lot of devs have. You don't really have a say, and you can't just run away from that kind of thing forever. But yeah, it's not something that I have to think about at all working at Santa Monica Studio, nor a thing that I think any first party Sony game really has to worry about, which is awesome.
Does it worry you just on the, just as part of the broader industry, the fact that it does seem that there are certain companies that are gravitating towards, you know, hyper monetizing microtransactions and or incorporating cryptocurrency and NFTs into more mainstream platforms?
For sure. The thing that I get most concerned about most frequently as a gamer is the loss of single player video games, and it's not something that like is going to disappear anytime soon. You know, the headlines that would suggest that are really just being clickbaity. But you know, I grew up playing single player games. They're what I want to work on. They're more interesting to me as a writer. Though of course, multiplayer teams, you know, they have to work super hard too. But I don't want to lose that. And you know, the NFT marketplace conversation, for example, is like, okay, well, if we were to implement them in a way that would make any sense, then it wouldn't just seem like blatant theft right now. Yeah. It would have to be in games as service games. And so therefore, the more profitable NFTs get for publishers, the more games as service games you're going to get, which means the less single player games. They're going to be making more and more games, or rather less games, but putting more time into just one game. And then the competition doesn't become which of these, you know, 50 games a year do you buy because you think it looks interesting. It becomes more of how do you allocate your time. And it's something that, you know, I know that Activision specifically has been working on for a really long time. So seeing the shift with Microsoft is actually seems like a positive where this is concerned. And this is all like publicly available information that they have in their investor calls, is trying to monetize the amount of hours that somebody spends playing an individual game more effectively. So they're like, well, if somebody goes and sees a movie and it's only 2 hours and they pay $11 for a ticket, why can't we get at least $11 out of somebody who's played this game for 300 hours? That's not fair. We're being ripped off. We need to monetize the individual minutes that they play more effectively. And yeah, with that comes games as service games, which is a lot harder to tell a story in. I just like seeing like more variety every year, and I do worry that we head in a direction where somebody like Tencent just makes the metaverse game where everybody just gets sucked into it and doesn't want to play anything else. That's a thing that I don't want, and that I think, you know, isn't unrealistic that that could happen somewhere in the future, that we are all playing the Ready Player One style, just like one individual game that's sucking up all of our time because they've manipulated it to do that. And I don't want that, but hopefully that's like 20, 30 years away.
Well, like, I'm totally with you, because I've been hearing that, like, I'm also someone who loves single player games. And I've been hearing that argument, though, that they are going to die, especially AAA studios just won't have any time for them, because why would they when these, you know, massive multiplayer games can generate more money? And then we'll get like, you know, the new Resident Evil Village come out, and it's just one of the best games of the year, an absolute blast to play. So do you, as someone who works directly in that industry, feel that is really the only direction they're going to go in? Because I feel even Santa Monica Studios itself seems to still think that, you know, single player adventures can be a profitable business model from the perspective of a game developer of their size.
I'm putting on like my journalist hat to talk about this rather than my Santa Monica Studio hat. My perspective on that has always been, and I've never heard this from anybody internally, I think somebody said the contrary on Twitter recently, but it's always been my perspective, is that Sony is still incentivized to make really, really good single-player AAA video games because they want to sell PlayStations. So what they're selling is not the monetized hours of a video game, it's hardware. I think the same applies to Nintendo. Obviously, Microsoft has a different approach because of Game Pass. They are doing something very different. And that's why I feel like so many Sony first-party releases and Nintendo first-party releases are so good, is because they need you to buy their hardware to play the thing. And then from there, you know, you become a PlayStation Plus subscriber, and every game that you buy on PSN, Sony gets a 30% cut. So you just generate revenue for them all the time. And I think that the upside of exclusivity where that's concerned, is that we are going to keep getting really, really, really good single-player games from those studios unless they start chasing Game Pass and then things changes. That's not to say that I don't think Xbox makes great games, too. Like, I'm super excited about Hellblade 2. I loved Psychonauts 2. I've always been a fan of Sea of Thieves. They make great games as well. Super excited about Fable. But the Game Pass model means something different, for sure. It's a different approach to development, so... Yeah, I think you're pretty much always safe with PlayStation and Nintendo unless they change their strategies anytime soon.
Even with the new addition of them now porting major titles to PC?
Yeah, in my head, again, this is like content creator hat, not Sony hat. Because it's happening a year later, I don't think it matters. I think because it's still happening way after the fact and people like don't want to miss out on playing it day and date and getting it like day one, there's still so much of a push for you to try to get a PlayStation from that, basically. So I don't feel like that actually takes away. I feel like that's just great. Like, I want more people to be able to play more video games. Generally, like, I'd prefer if exclusivity didn't exist, but then I worry that we'd lose the quality. So that's the upside to it. But yeah, I'm happy to have PC players playing games that have previously been on consoles. That's awesome.
How do you feel about the kind of rise and blossoming of the indie game scene, especially that came kind of at the face of AAA game studios and maybe some of their more predatory practices, and suddenly becoming this entirely new, like, field? Like, not that, sorry, that it's new, but like smaller game studios producing these incredible, like, single player adventures. There's a lot of like Metroidvania games, all that kind of stuff. Do you feel that that is going to also continue to thrive in direct opposition to the AAA game studios who are pumping out the titles that everyone knows and loves?
That space is super interesting because it keeps changing. So, like, for example, I love the indie space. My game of the year last year was Inscription, but that is technically Devolver Digital, which means it was published. So is it an indie? I feel like I get so caught up on, like, what indie even means anymore, because if somebody, like, a game like Journey was indie game-ish but was published by Sony, so is it an indie game? Like, I don't even know what that term means anymore. Like, I loved Inscription so much and would feel like in my head it's indie, but it's still published by Devolver Digital, so it's super confusing. And I feel like that's a thing that's shifting in that space, is like less self-published indies for sure. We are getting more published indies by these like middle, like double A studios. I don't even know what indie means anymore. I definitely don't think they're going anywhere though. I think that there are too many people, even students, who like just want to make something cool, and often do, and don't have the constraints of working in AAA, where they can take the time and as much time as they want. They can take like 6 years to make something if they want to. And I hope they don't go anywhere. But yeah, I don't see them going anywhere either, because that's a really good way for Game Pass to pad its library. You have more studios making indie games. That's awesome. For Sony to have a more interesting catalog of smaller things throughout the year. Obviously, Nintendo, loads of indie games have done super well on the Switch eShop. So I think that we need those, because AAA takes so long to make games that you need to have like your nice little indies in the middle. And that industry does such cool stuff. Well, that side of the industry does stuff, such cool stuff. Like, I also played Unpacking last year, which is like such an unexpectedly pleasant indie game that was funded by the Australian government in part. Which, you know, again, that's a pretty common approach for a lot of indies, is to get funding elsewhere, which is awesome. And that's something that you could just never make in the AAA space. So, yeah, I think there's too many people wanting to make smaller and more unique games that they're not going to go anywhere. And there's benefit for the big publishers as well. Like, I love indies. Long may they live. They're awesome.
Do you think Game Pass is kind of where the future of the industry will go, in that there's going to be like just a Netflix alternative? That's pretty much what Game Pass feels like to me. It's like the Netflix of video games, right? You pay $10 a month and you get 100 different titles, more than anyone can play in a month. Is that going to be something that is emulated by PS Plus, by Nintendo? Is that the future of video games?
I hope not, in that I love Game Pass. You know, I use Game Pass. I think it's great value. But the minute that everybody's doing the same thing, I feel like we get less innovation just as a result of that. So I think that Microsoft's play is actually to compete with Google and Apple, not to compete with PlayStation and Nintendo. I think that they're trying to do something quite different. And I'm glad that they are. I hope that not everybody does. But I mean, there's a world where we can end up the same way that TV streaming services are right now. And I think the appeal of that is passive income. It's a lot of people giving you money for things they aren't even necessarily touching. I think they're making millions now. I don't remember what it was. They just released the stats of how many subscribers that they have. Like, it's super profitable. But then video games are also really expensive to make. So it's so new that it's hard to see right now how it's going to play out in the long term. But my definite hope is that everybody continues to do different things. I like that Nintendo get very innovative with their hardware and make a very specific style of game. I like taking my Switch on a plane. I like that I can use it and I don't have to be connected to the internet with a subscription service to play anything. And again, I love the blockbusters that PlayStation make. I'm super excited for the new Horizon next month. I think Guerrilla's doing fantastic stuff there. Loved Ghost of Tsushima and the Director's Cut. And I want them all to keep doing different stuff so that, like, as a gamer who has every platform, I get different stuff. But that's probably me being greedy. Like, realistically, I don't know. The industry has to go where the money is. And I don't know where that is right now, but that's where it'll go.
Yeah. Are you able to wear your journalist hat to talk a little bit about Activision Blizzard, or would you rather just leave that topic off?
Cool.
I wanted to first ask about, within the industry itself, was there a lot of knowledge of Activision Blizzard and everything that was taking place there, behind the scenes kind of idea before this was becoming the public scandal that it was? Was it kind of like a rumor that was talked about into, do you think the acquisition by Microsoft, is that necessarily something that could either save those companies, or is it just kind of like the way Disney is trying to inhale every other form of media ever known, right? Is Microsoft trying to become the next Disney in the video game world?
GG Mickey Mouse. Yeah. So first, I, you know, have had loads of friends at Activision Blizzard who I knew, for some of those people, this doesn't apply to everybody, were like very stressed a lot of the time. I had no idea about any of the like more serious allegations, anything about sexual harassment or sexual assault. And there are two sides to that. The first is that, like, it's so common in the games industry that I feel like people probably didn't feel a need to talk about it. That was one of my, like, gut reactions to seeing that news, you know, flood my Twitter timeline, was people being, like, shocked about it. And I was like, well, this is kind of par for the course. This is so common, that it was really unsurprising in a way that's obviously very gross, but that leads me to think maybe people didn't talk about it as much because it was happening at so many studios. So no, I'd never heard of any of the like sexual harassment or sexual assault claims. The other side of that is that I imagine a lot of people who worked there hadn't either. It's scary to talk about that shit, you know, like it's really terrifying to try to come forward, especially in the face of like a culture where even if you know that certain people would care, they would maybe have to pretend that they didn't because that's how their boss feels and they need to impress that person. And it just like, there's a million reasons why I feel like it probably wasn't spoken about that extensively, which is disgusting. But yeah, I don't feel like there were even rumors of it that I had ever heard. I didn't know about any of it really. I just knew that people who I knew who worked there were like really stressed all the time, which again, also not that uncommon. Second, is Microsoft trying to become Disney? No, I think that Microsoft is just trying to focus on Game Pass. I don't think there's necessarily a threat of Microsoft buying up every studio. And the thing that I've been thinking about, you know, that I feel like people aren't talking about is the amount that Tencent has done that. Tencent is currently the biggest company in terms of revenue in the games industry, Chinese company. And they have some really bad practices that I'm almost like even like weird about speaking about, because I know that Tencent can like treat people pretty poorly for talking about it in a way that's kind of scary. Like they, I guess I should say like allegedly or from what I have heard, please don't sue me for saying this, will buy a studio and then effectively steal their code and then just like replicate their games. And there are some studios that like can be bought by Tencent or get shares from Tencent that have to like give over their source code. Oh. And as a result of that, become worthless to every other publisher going forward, because then anyone can just Tencent can at any point just replicate everything that you've made. And they do it in a way that's really strange. So I feel like they are the biggest. They're the ones that I look at as like trying to chase a monopoly and owning the industry. They also have like a bunch of problematic shit. I have a friend who had a film that was offered to be made by Tencent or funded by Tencent, and they were like, no black people, bigger tits.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Like a lot of like rules that they have that.
Okay.
Yeah. That I think also has had a hand in, you know, some AAA games. Again, I don't want to speak on any of this because I'm so worried about getting sued by Tencent, but this is what I've heard, rumors, not sure if any of this is true. But, you know, like, even games that are out where they were like, yeah, that character needs to have bigger tits, or you need to make her skin lighter type shit.
Wow.
That, again, I know that more of the film industry, and that's outside of content that's like, no ghosts, they have just, like, weird rules like that, but I think we should be way more concerned about Tencent than we should be about Microsoft. And then even then, the second biggest company in terms of revenue, I believe, is still Sony, and then Microsoft, and then we've got Apple. So like, you know, these big studio acquisitions, in some cases, I think they're awesome. I think that buying a studio like Double Fine is great because Double Fine make really good games, and now they have like more secure ongoing funding to continue to make awesome games. I felt the same way about, forgetting the name, Ninja Theory. You know, I want Ninja Theory to keep making great games, and them getting acquired by a big publisher is awesome. In terms of Activision Blizzard, I really hope that the acquisition can be better for all the employees there and can improve the culture and obviously get rid of Bobby Kotick. That sounds great. Mm-hmm. Really like that to happen. Even though it looks like he's going to get like $300 million regardless, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not super worried about a monopoly with them right now, just because there are other companies I'm slightly more worried about. And it's something that you definitely don't ever want one company to own everything. I don't like it with Disney. I feel like a lot of their movies are really formulaic and have the same act structure and the same sense of humor and play out in the same way that it kind of starts to feel stale. So you don't want it to happen, but I don't feel like Bethesda and Activision Blizzard are quite enough to get to that point. If they also bought Ubisoft and EA, I think that we'd be in trouble.
Do you think there's a reason why no one speaks about Tencent? Because I'll completely agree with you. I was not aware of like any of the things you just brought up. And like for someone who follows that section of the news a lot, especially when it comes to like workers' rights involving like people who work in the video game industry, workers' rights for people who are trying to like protest. Like we interviewed a bunch of Activision people who are unionizing in their drive and stuff. But oftentimes those are the companies that are pointed towards, right? It's like the big ones, the EAs, you know, the ones that where they have notorious bad practices to their employees. But I've never heard someone criticize Tencent before.
Like I said, I think people are afraid of them. But I think the biggest one is probably that they're overseas. So because they're foreign, less people understand, less people know people who work there or don't have personal relationships with the people who work there. They just like buy up half of Riot and then kind of disappear. So they're a little bit more mysterious. So I think it's half-half. It's being afraid of them because they have so much power over entertainment in the West in general. Again, also loads of films. Like, Tencent are massive in a really scary way. This is like this scary conglomerate that nobody really knows much about. But yeah, also because they're overseas. It's either that like people aren't taking them seriously because they're a Chinese company or because we don't have as much access to them and they don't have as much of a home base. So we just don't know people who work there the same way we do with every other studio.
Fair enough. When it came to the Activision Blizzard, one of the things I'd say one of the only positives that came out of it was the fact that there was like a drive for unionization, some walkouts, and now there's a testers union apparently that is trying to get recognition from the larger company. Do you feel right now within the industry there is a concerned push towards things like more unionization? Or I've even heard rumors about when companies do their mass like firing of contract workers, they will band together and perhaps try forming like a worker co-op to start a whole new game company. Is there like a lot of push towards that from people in the industry and or from like the journalistic aspect of things?
I think no. I think that there should be. I unions are for the people. I personally am very pro union. Unions seem great. But I don't really hear people talk about it super often internally inside of the industry. It seems like an idea that's floated that nobody necessarily knows how to do or execute on. And yeah, I guess people are probably worried about union busting. Like, I can't imagine that the Amazon game studios are pushing real hard on unions, considering Amazon's stance. So it definitely seems like a thing that would be beneficial, but it would also require like such a big industry shakeup because it is an industry that has a lot of people working a lot of overtime and not getting paid for it. Games that, you know, I know people who worked on games at EA who, what a thankless job, who've like ended up in hospital because they, you know, the idea that crunch is just like, oh, you worked a bit of overtime. No, like people were like collapsing and going to hospital because they were so overworked and stressed and it's so bad for you mentally in some cases that yeah, they take medical leave because they can't keep working anymore. Like, yeah, those people clearly need some intervention to help them. Like, it's wild that it operates that way. That's also seemingly the only way that some games can get out. And I think that like the discourse is pretty negative where a lot of that stuff is concerned in terms of like, why haven't you released this game yet? Where's the release date for this? Like, there's a lot of pressure from the public, which can also translate to pressure from stakeholders as well, just like going around in a circle of people getting angry. And then the EA games come out and everyone hates them anyway. And you're like, cool, my friend had to go to hospital to make like any of that work. And it's just like so negative in this little ball. And people like The Quartering really help with that, I think. Very, very helpful for the unions. And it's just it's difficult to figure out how to approach, I imagine. And I don't doubt that somebody will, but as it stands right now, I think that some of the union touting that I see journalists yell about on Twitter, I'm like, that is a tremendous privilege that you have, that you had the time to figure out how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, they seem great to me. I don't feel like it's a priority for a lot of people, though, just because it's probably unrealistic and seems difficult. And yeah, it would require a pretty big industry shift to make them work, and nobody knows how to do that.
Fair enough. It's funny you mentioned The Quartering, because one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about is obviously him and, I guess, the neckbeards online are, you know, the kind of people the two of us have battled quite a bit in terms of them being upset about representation and stuff of that nature, and that video games may be going the way of films and being too woke for their consumption or stuff of that nature. But as someone who actually works in the industry itself, do you feel that the problem of representation in video games is being properly addressed? And do you think that it is a more welcoming environment for people who might want to get into the industry who happen to not be cis white males kind of thing?
I don't like, I'm a white woman. I'm still second, you know, like, I feel like I'm not on like the a ladder. Great person, you know, to be like, yeah, representation's doing great. Like, okay, white girl, there are people who have it much harder than I do, and I don't want to, like, even pretend that I can say, no, they're fine because the white women are fine, you know?
Good answer.
Not that they are. just, like, I don't know how to tackle that appropriately. I feel like the thing, again, about that discourse that's very confusing is, like, people being like, you're getting pressure to make it more woke. And it's like, no, the people who make these games just, like, want to do this. They just want to. They want to work with different people and more diverse teams. Because having, especially as a writer, having a diverse team of people to pull ideas from is way more interesting. Like, you get better ideas when you don't have a similar background or a similar upbringing. And I think, like, that even comes from, you know, me being from a different country, even in a small way, can provide like a, well, I have this perspective because I came from this different place. And that's obviously way, way, way richer when it comes to people of different ethnicities and backgrounds in every facet. So I think it's like people in the industry just like want to tell more interesting stories. And that comes with working with more diverse people. There's no like big publisher pressure to be like, you must hire more black people. It's like, well, that person was qualified and is interesting. We want to work with them. It's not mm-hmm. this like weird bogeyman of like this like woke overlord that I feel like they reference all the time that I'm like, no, they just fucking wanted to do that. It's so strange. That, yeah, I think people assume that some of their favorite game studios don't have people wanting to make that kind of content in them. And like, of course they do. So yeah, I think that it's the industry's been around for a long enough time that telling those different stories with different backgrounds is just becoming like more and more important to tell different stories. And I definitely feel like it's progressing in a way where people are trying harder. And that's a big thing that always comes down to part of that conversation of like, this person was hired for this diversity reason. Like, why are you trying to tell people on Twitter to apply, especially if they're a person of color? And it's one thing that I think that still needs a lot of work is making things seem more welcoming for people to actually apply for jobs. That's the thing that I don't think has progressed as much as the industry would like. Is it's still scary to apply for a job at a game studio if you know that the people who work there don't look like you. And I think that can even happen in a way where it's like, well, I haven't really seen myself represented in that space, so I don't feel like I belong. And I think that it's not about hiring people who aren't good at the job. Of course you are always going to end up hiring the most qualified person. Like, that happened when I worked at IGN as well. I do think that recruiters need to do a better job of trying to get more diverse applicants, though. You're still always going to hire the person who's most qualified regardless of what they look like, but you do need to put more work into trying to make different people feel more comfortable applying or getting those applications or approaching them or trying to poach them from different places. Because that's definitely something that I don't think the industry's figured out yet. But again, white woman.
Well, okay,
I'm all right.
I mean, that's a really good answer. The other thing I wanted to ask in regards to that, though, is I guess during the feminist frequency slash kind of like Gamergate explosion of this topic, there was the problem in prior video games, which were predominantly obviously written and coded and designed by men, of being hyper-focused perhaps on only having women as these like hyper-sexualized characters. And now I feel like we have come a really long way where you were just mentioning a game like Event Horizon, for example, that has a very, positive, powerful, female protagonist that isn't directly concerned exclusively with like their sexuality being the only character trait that you think about. And at the same time, there seems to be an area open for characters that are still sexualized, such as like the vampire mummy in the new Resident Evil game, right? Something that no one was really that questionable about. But do you feel like that has kind of evolved in a positive route since the mass exposure of it? Or do you think there is still a very big problem with, female game characters being predominantly sexual characters rather than anything else?
I can only speak for myself here, and I don't know if my take is like a super common one on this. So I play video games my whole life and have never had a problem with sexy female video game characters. And I feel like part of that conversation I find to be a little bit exhausting in terms of like, I don't know, it's confusing to me that some of it is like, we must have our female video game characters to dress this way to pass a test. But then at the same breath, those people would be like, women, dress however you want in real life. So it's confusing to me. It's like, well, am I allowed to dress however I want, or must I dress this way to be approved? But what drives me nuts, and a thing that I've always hated, it's not sexy video game characters. Totally cool with that. And this is why Lady D, I think, was so beloved, is that they have to also be interesting. And that was certainly a thing that I think the industry was very bad at, that the industry has gotten better at. Is making sexy video game characters where their whole identity is also just being sexy video game character. So boring. It's so boring and can be really grating. There used to be so many villains that were just like a hot chick who would just flirt with you. And when I was playing those even as a teenager, when, I had some like dumb Tumblr posts about how I thought feminism was stupid because I spent too much time on 4chan. And I've since learned better. Where even then I was like, this is clearly not made for me, and it's weird, because I was just so acutely aware that it was written as a woman flirting with the straight man playing the game. And that could be super off-putting. So I love characters like Bayonetta, right? Super sexualized. She's there's no question about the way that she's dressed, but she's also really interesting. And I feel like that's the thing that like I think has come a long way, and that I care more about, is not acting like all of our female video game characters need to be dressed a certain way, or need to look a certain way, or have to be covered up in a certain way. It's more that they have to just be interesting characters. I feel like I don't like the trope of badass female character where she's got the side of her head is shaved, and in a cutscene she's like boxing or sharpening a knife. I'm like, I get that what you're trying to do there is like you're trying to create a strong female character, but it ends up in the same place, which is not a fucking character. It's like one and the same to me, I don't want every video game character to be sexy, male gazy. That's weird. But I don't want them to all look the same either. And I don't want them to all dress the same. And I don't want like the video games that I play to be like, if you look sexy, then you suck. I prefer to be it somewhere in the middle. Just make the characters interesting and compelling and have real struggles and relatable beats. I think that's probably that I'm a writer, so my perspective is coming from that area. But yeah, that's certainly improving, I think, and has over the last 10 years especially. But I don't know, if you want someone who's super slutty, I'm cool with that too. Just don't make them like a walking innuendo.
I've got my chat lighting me up for good reason. Apparently I said Event Horizon instead of Horizon Zero Dawn. You're completely correct. There is no Event Horizon video game coming out, which would be, that would be pretty based. It was a scary fun movie. I know that we've only got a few minutes left because we've got a lot of other events and interviews to do. Do you mind if I ask you just a couple questions from the chat? They've been adding me a lot of things that they want to ask you. One of the first questions that I received, and I've had it a couple times now, is can you talk a little bit about being LGBTQ+ in the industry and what that was like?
Yeah, so I've been like not straight my whole life, and I've known that my whole life. It has never been a struggle for me, which makes it a complicated thing to talk about. I've never had any problem with it. My family has kind of always known and never cared. And it's never been an issue. And thus, I feel like most people just don't know. And I have to like point it out if it comes up or something. So The reception when I had never hidden it. I have YouTube videos dating back 10 years where I talk about being attracted to women, and men, and everything else. I don't care what you identify as. And it felt like I never hid it, but I decided to post about it on Twitter maybe 2 years ago after talking to a couple of friends in that community who were like, because you haven't publicly spoken about this, people don't know, and if they see you as successful or they look up to you, I think it would be really helpful if you did. So I went back and forth with a bunch of people and was like, this feels performative and strange because it's not something that I feel like I personally have needed to write a twit longer about. But it just came down to everybody I asked being like, no, you could really help people if you do this. You could make people more comfortable coming out or like with their identities. So I posted something, and there were some like shitheads on the internet who didn't like it, but I didn't care. So I would say that it's not something I've ever felt in any way discluded for in the games industry whatsoever. The reception for me has always been super nice and supportive and friendly.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. So this one might be a little bit more specific, but I have a question I've always wanted to ask. You spoke very highly of the first Deadly Premonition game and introduced me to it, but with the second game having come out 2 years ago, what would you have done or changed with the game if you wrote it?
With Deadly Premonition, the first one or the second one?
I believe the second one.
What would I change in Deadly Premonition 2? My God.
Very specific.
Okay. To get like pretty harsh on it, the entire first hour of that game sort of sucks. I think the writing in Deadly Premonition is very good, and people would argue that because it's really weird, but it's good. The characters are super consistent. You understand their struggles. They're just very strange. The first hour of Deadly Premonition is basically like a visual novel. Like it's so weird and on rails that I just want to cut that whole thing. Like, get me straight to the weird skateboarding part with the strange alligator figure. Just jump right to that, because that's the chaos that I love Deadly Premonition for. It's truly, truly one of the best and worst video game series in history.
I'll end with an easy one. What were the best and worst titles of 2021 in your gaming opinion?
So my favorite game of 2021 was Inscription, as said. I also really liked Deathloop and Psychonauts. I'm going to forget things now. What I'm trying to think about games I didn't like that came out last year. I wasn't a huge fan of The Gunk. I did finish it, of games that I was like interested in that I played. I felt like and one of my friends voices the lead character of that game, and that was awesome to see. But I felt like the gameplay loop was a lot simpler than I expected. Not a ton grabbed me there. If it had been longer, I wouldn't have committed to finishing it, I don't think. But because it was short, I was like, yeah, it's simple, it's pleasant, it's cool, I'll play it. I think of what else I played last year that I wasn't a huge fan of. Like, the most recent AAA game that I really did not like was Avengers. I was just not into that in any facet, and I guess that's ongoing. And I did try it again last year after an update and still had like major problems with it and so many bugs on the PC build. It was just like, at one point it bricked my PC. I had to unplug my PC from the power outlet because that game just could not function on my PC. I'm sure it wasn't easy to make, though. You know, that's got to be hard to make. And I generally love that studio. I'm trying to think of like what else came out last year. What else came out?
I didn't know Psychonauts 2 came out last year. I thought that was a 2019 release.
No, that definitely came out last year. Yeah,
that was last year. I guess Village was another big title that came out last year as well.
Loved it. Huge fan. Thought it was great. They do this thing with Resident Evil, though, that Village didn't do as bad as the previous game did, where the end of the game gets so action-y that I miss some of the earlier parts. I mean, mm-hmm. They've done that for ages, actually. That's like the Resident Evil formula almost. And it like kind of loses me towards the end when I'm like flying in a tank. Like, I'm always like, all right, can I go back to the houses? Like, I just prefer those bits. I still really liked it, though. I thought it was dope.
Can I ask you just one more quick question? Because you actually might have an insight to this. And this is something that I'm very passionate about. Will we ever see a Silent Hills, do you think? We'll ever see either what that game was supposed to be or another Silent Hill? Or is Konami perpetually going to be a pachinko machine maker and they'll never give away the license?
Konami will never do it, but they might sell it. I wouldn't say no to Konami selling it. And I've thought about this as like, you know, since I started working at SMS, other studios have tried to poach me, and I'm always like, absolutely not. There's no way. The only thing you could poach me on is Silent Hills. If I had the opportunity to go write Silent Hills, I 100% would be like, okay, let's do that. But part of it is that, like, I don't know that I necessarily want it because PT is so good. I think PT is one of the best games of Lost Generation, even though it's not a game, right?
Yeah,
it's fucking incredible. And the idea that the loss of Silent Hill as a franchise ends on this weird demo that you didn't know was Silent Hill until the end of it, that was made in partnership with Guillermo del Toro, that you can only get certain ways now and is only available on certain people's platforms and was otherwise like mysteriously delisted and is no longer referenced, is like kind of beautiful. Like,
it's very creepy.
If that's it, that's kind of cool. We could let somebody else overtake the survival horror space. I'm super excited about the new Alan Wake, because I feel like Remedy has a lot of like the same kind of approach to writing that Silent Hill does. Like, I love Silent Hill too. I think there's a world where Konami sells it to make a bunch of money, because clearly they like that. I also wouldn't hate it if we never saw another Silent Hill, solely because I think the ending is so Silent Hill-esque. It's kind of cool.
Well said. Do you have a charity event coming up? You always have so many charity streams and fundraisers. Do you have another big one that we could promote?
I do. All of my streams are for charity. Right now, I am raising money for the people who lost their homes in Boulder, Colorado. I'm actually not doing any more streams for the rest of this month because I really want to finish the screenplay that I was writing. So I was like, I need to stop streaming so I can do more writing. But the link is, it's like in my Instagram bio, and you'd be able to find it on my Tilted Pipe page just in general. Yeah, because I went to Colorado over the Christmas break and happened to be there while the fires were there and wanted to do something to try to help out, and met people who lost their homes, like at, you know, a grocery store buying food. And the person in front of me was like, yeah, we just had to buy some stuff because our whole house burned down. And you're like, oh, cool.
Wow.
That happened a couple of times. So that's what I'm currently trying to raise money for this month to help some people out. So yeah, if you'd like to donate, that would be awesome.
And they can find Jad at twitch.tv/Charizard, spelt the right way.
Charalanazard, yes.
Charalanazard, sorry.
That is correct.
Alana, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and letting me ask all these wild questions, because it's really cool finally hearing from someone who's like on the inside of all this stuff.
Yeah, sure. I'm always happy to talk about video games. It's my favorite thing, so anytime.
Oh, one last thing. Someone wants to know what your favorite Pokemon is. I'm going to guess I know what it is, but...
It's actually Gyarados.
Oh, twist! Twist!
I know.
There you go, Cervantes.
Actually twist Gyarados, yeah. Who'd have guessed?
Well, thank you so much, Lana. I appreciate it. Take it easy.
Cool. Thanks so much for having me. Bye!
Everyone, that was the incredible Alana Pierce. Every single one of you should probably go do that thing where you go over to Twitter or you go over to Twitch and then you go subscribe and you follow. And also, if you can, if you have a dollar to spare, go participate in that charity stream coming up, because that would be amazing. That was awesome learning so much stuff. At least I managed to count it at the end of it. I'll put the whole thing up on the YouTubes or on the podcast if you want to have it in your ear pleasure. And go follow and sub to Alana, because she's very based. The two of us, I think, the first time I ever hung out with her online was the AOC room game, and then I've subsequently seen her dunking on the quartering and other neckbeards on a regular basis. So, like, you know, she's dope. So please go follow her, go watch her stuff. So you've just been listening to an episode of The Surf Times, and if you enjoy it and want to see The Surf Times, you can go to wearesurfs.com or watch the live shows at thesurfs.tv. And also everywhere social media is sold, basically thesurfs.tv, you'll find us there. twitter.com/thesurfstv, for example. It would also help us out tremendously if you could leave a good review of this podcast if you enjoyed it, either on, I don't know, iTunes or wherever you're podcasting. Apparently it does help, and yeah, we hope to see you soon.
To our gods, Xander Corvus and Peyton L. Just, we beseech thee to smite down our enemies. To our monarch, Tom Spiker, We are but your humble court jesters, here to amuse you. To our lords, Trevor R., we give thanks for this spit of land for us to eke out this meager existence. To our knights, Merid, Cheryl Alvarez, Ruby Kelly, Ellie Leslie, Alex P., Brandon, Words Greenwood, Nate, that one guy, Hagbird Celine, Matthew Scarborough, Stellar Vision, Ariane McCarthy, Daniel Sutton, Coulter Smith, Val 9000, Jenna Tall, Quiet 185, Anna Loves Riley, Omni, Riley and Anna, Poodle Hawk, The Tim Caucus, Multi Mondi, Trevor Yanis, Lemmy 101, Anthropofojack, Saren 42, Catherine, Radical Maniac, Ramon Acosta, Nkosin, Violent Orchard, Sophie Baby, Political Puppy, Andreas Chiringuito, Zach Christensen, Josh Mickelson, Todd Buckingham, and Todd Lajeunesse. We raise our flagon of ale, and we salute you, our friends.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.